I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, we'll take a close look at the state of New Jersey's plans for Atlantic City. First, 50 candidates for a new work initiative came to Philadelphia City Hall for job interviews today. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports on a new program that aims to help those who spent time behind bars.
Councilman Kenyatta Johnson says for years he's been concerned about helping ex-offenders find work.
I remember doing 2 summers ago. We would go block to block, door to door, corner to corner, in the evening in South Philadelphia, offering resources to young men to get off the corner so they can make positive choices as opposed to engaging in a life of crime.
Johnson says this $500,000 program helps the city meet a need, improving vacant lots, while reducing the odds that former inmates will return to prison.
We cannot arrest our way out of this situation. People will go away on State Road. They will go away to Greatest Fort. But at the end of the day, they will come back to the communities. And so I'm proud to stand here to be supportive of this particular initiative that focuses on not only reforming individuals coming home from our criminal justice system, but also addressing the issue of blight, making sure that young people have a chance to go rebuild.
Terrell Bagby is head of reentry service for the city and says he's thankful when an employer wants to take a chance on someone with a criminal record.
Nothing combats employment discrimination against returning citizens, actually giving them a job and giving them a chance to produce themselves or prove themselves in the job. In order to reduce our prison population and save taxpayers millions, we need to ensure that former offenders have meaningful opportunities to become productive citizens.
The program seeks to clean and green 2,000 lots around Philadelphia. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
A Philadelphia lawyer is officially kicking off his campaign against indicted Congressman Shaka Fatah this evening. As WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports, he's one of 4 Democrats expected to challenge the lawmaker who's fighting federal corruption charges.
Dan Mura from Mount Airy has never run for public office, but he did spend nearly a decade working for politicians on Capitol Hill. The 48-year-old says that would be a big help if he was elected to lead the 2nd Congressional District, which includes parts of North, West, and Northwest Philly and most of Lower Merion Township.
I understand the place. I understand process. It's someplace where I would hit the ground running, and I know exactly how to get things done.
Halting gun violence will be an important issue for Muroff's campaign. He thinks it'll resonate with voters in crime-ridden neighborhoods in the district.
We need to raise the level of attention amongst progressive-minded people that gun violence needs serious, dedicated, committed attention to pass some reasonable legislation.
Muroff says the political corruption charges against Fatah only played an indirect part in his decision to run. State Representatives Dwight Evans and Brian Sims, as well as Lower Merion Township Commissioner Brian Gordon, also plan to challenge Fatah in April's Democratic primary. Because of the district's makeup, that election will effectively crown the next congressman. Muroff doesn't have the name recognition of Evans, considered Fatah's biggest competition, but he says he hopes fundraising can help offset that. He says he's raised about $200,000 so far. In comparison, Congressman Fatah had less than $3,000 in his campaign account, according to his last financial report. I'm Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
Governor Chris Christie and Senate President Steve Sweeney hope New Jersey lawmakers act quickly on a plan for the state to take control of Atlantic City's finances. Let's look at the proposal intended to stave off bankruptcy with Dr. James Hughes, Dean of the Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University. Dean Hughes, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure.
Dean, what are the highlights of the deal announced yesterday?
Well, one of the highlights of the deal is a lack of detail. Essentially, the state wants to make all of the decisions related to financial matters and to personnel matters. And essentially, how the legislature is actually going to write that bill that gives the state that power is yet uncertain. But the bottom line is it's very difficult for local officials to reduce jobs, to reduce the size of government because of the tremendous political power at the local level or political opposition. That's dimension one of being able to downsize government without causing, you know, major panic. And then the second one is to make very, very hard fiscal decisions of who is going to get paid, because the city is going to run out of money. It has a very significant debt. It owes money to the casinos. And again, a state authority is able to make that decision with a little bit more political insulation.
As dean of the Blaustein School, do you think this is sound planning and public policy, the direction that Governor Christie is proposing?
I think it's the only course of action available right now. If the city went bankrupt, I think it would be such a mess that it would take years to unravel it.
To what extent is the Camden example an analogy to what will now be taking place perhaps in Atlantic City?
It's a pretty good analogy, I think. It's not exactly the same. Again, we don't know the full details of the Atlantic City, and maybe the state doesn't even know that right now either. So that's going to be crafted, I think, over the ensuing weeks. But the model of having the county taking over the city police department, of having the state having some fiscal input and responsibility and the like, sort of the broad principles are similar.
What are causes for optimism in the short and or long run?
Well, with the state being involved, it means the state may well have to put some resources into Atlantic City to keep it afloat. So that is a possibility. The state now bears some responsibility. It may give people more confidence to invest in Atlantic City, knowing that it will not go bankrupt. And there still are being investments made, even though casino gaming is declining. There's been some expansion of convention meeting facilities at some of the casinos. Some of the casinos have upgraded themselves. There's been additional retail development in the city. And if those investors that are doing that investment lose confidence in the city, then that's going to stop right in its tracks.
Thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight. Dr. James Hughes is dean of the Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University. Taking a look at this evening's headlines, a federal grand jury charges former Philadelphia election official Renee Tartaglione with stealing from a mental health clinic where she served as board chair. Assistant U.S. Attorney B. Witzleben says Tartaglione bought a building, charged the clinic exorbitant rent, and then tried to cover up her acts.
Well, the grand jury has alleged that Ms. Tartaglione, among other things, fabricated records, including minutes of the board of directors of Juniata Community Mental Health Clinic, to make it appear as though the board had approved some of these things, which in fact they had not approved.
Tartaglione's attorney says she'll plead not guilty. A federal judge rules that attorneys for Congressman Chaka Fattah cannot leave his federal corruption case. In an order filed with Philadelphia's U.S. District Court, Judge Harvey Bartle says though Fattah has not paid his attorneys recently, they in turn cannot desert the 11-term congressman as he prepares for trial. At a hearing yesterday, Fattah's attorney said if they aren't allowed to leave, it would literally crush the five-attorney practice. The representation is expected to cost millions of dollars, since the trial of Fattah and his four co-defendants could last from 6 to 8 weeks. Clear skies, 36 degrees at 614. You're listening to NewsWorks tonight on WHYY. The evening forecast, clear, cold overnight, low 21 degrees. Sunny tomorrow, Thursday's high around 40. Friday, a mix of sun and clouds, high 40 degrees. And then sunny days right through the weekend. Saturday's high around 40, closer to 50 degrees on Sunday. You're listening to WHYY. Still ahead, a Camden clinic fights the city's overdose problem with a prescription drug.
To be quite honest, I'd rather see someone on Suboxone than on heroin.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Oil's cheap, gas is cheap, but hey, you've got a hot new electric car.
The Bolt really is an investment in the future, and so we look at this car to be the breakthrough to take EVs mainstream.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the woman whose job it is to make that happen. Next time on Marketplace from APN.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Annenberg Center Live supports WHYY and presents a rock and roll version of Shakespeare's comedy Twelfth Night. Britain's Filter Theatre and Royal Shakespeare Company team up to pair classical verse with modern rock in this fast-paced story of romance, satire, and mistaken identity. 12th night performances are February 9th through the 13th at Annenberg Center Live. Tickets for 12th night at 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Drug overdose fatalities are at an all-time high, propelled by the rise of prescription painkillers and addicts who often then turn to heroin. The epidemic is getting attention as it makes its way into the suburbs and rural areas. But in Camden, one of the nation's poorest cities, drug abuse has long been an issue. WHYY's Jessica McDonald takes us inside a clinic there trying to tackle the problem.
So patients come up. They sign in. They have a seat in the waiting room.
Here at Project Hope, a few blocks west of Broadway in Camden, social worker Brian Colangelo says it's all about primary care.
People come in for diabetes, hypertension, asthma, cut on their foot, when they have a cold.
The federally qualified health center is one of a few places other than emergency departments to treat homeless patients in New Jersey. Anyone who walks in, with or without insurance, can get care. People may come in for typical things like nagging colds, but at least once a day, physician Linda Baselli sees patients who are drunk or high. And she says giving good medical care means addressing those substance abuse issues first.
Whether they walked in because they need their blood pressure medicine or their diabetes medication, the addiction is their life-threatening illness. Their opioid dependence or whatever it is, their alcohol dependence. That's what's going to get them before the blood pressure or the diabetes will.
To help connect, there's Danielle Orlando, a peer advocate who's in recovery herself. She got hooked on heroin after first taking prescribed pain pills following some dental care.
A so-called friend said that they had something that was cheaper and, you know, better, and, you know, that's how I got into heroin. And it wasn't cheaper, but it was definitely better, and it just destroyed my life very quickly.
When Orlando's first grandchild was born, she was ready to quit. She got an appointment at Project Hope for a Friday, but couldn't wait. Desperate, she walked in on Wednesday, and they squeezed her in.
From that day on, they kind of helped me and gave me a script and been clean ever since that day.
That was more than a year and a half ago. The script was for buprenorphine, also known as Suboxone.
As soon as you take the Suboxone, it is a miracle drug because it kind of just, it stops the pain. And so, it's almost immediate.
Buprenorphine is an opioid. It binds to the same receptors in the brain as heroin or oxycodone, but doesn't pack the full punch. Instead of producing a high,
you don't really feel anything other than normal.
Orlando says for years, her only worry was how many bags of dope she had left. With buprenorphine, she can think again of her children, her job, and her bills.
I know I can wake up, my medication's available, take it, don't have a second thought, don't have any cravings, and I can function.
The transformation, Dr. Baselli says, is often remarkable. People literally look healthier.
It's actually stunning to see. They come back a few days later and it's like a different person. It's really cool. It's really cool.
Not everyone triumphs like Orlando, who's working at Project Hope and going to school full time. Most people taking buprenorphine relapse, not just once, but over and over. Some sell the drug on the street, where it's increasingly popular. Baselli says while the goal is to help patients into long-term recovery, there are smaller victories for patients who never get that far.
We've sort of managed to keep them alive, and we've managed to keep them out of the emergency room, out of the hospital, prevent overdoses. That's success also.
Buprenorphine is more difficult to OD on than either heroin or methadone. There's a ceiling effect that prevents more drug from giving more of a high, although it's still abused. Social worker Brian Colangelo says even if some of the medications they prescribe make it to street corners,
to be quite honest, I'd rather see someone on Suboxone than on heroin.
On the medication, he says, users decrease their risk of contracting HIV and hepatitis C. They're less likely to engage in risky or illegal behavior.
The more Suboxone that folks can have access to, the less heroin they're going to take.
But access to Suboxone and buprenorphine is restricted, in part by the government. Only doctors who are trained and sign up for a waiver are allowed to prescribe it. In the first year, physicians can treat only 30 patients. In following years, that goes up to 100. Project Hope has two of the eight doctors in Camden who are registered to prescribe the drug. But even here, Colangelo says more than 300 people are on the waiting list.
We probably get 6 to 10 phone call requests per day, people looking for Suboxone treatment. That's that's how much of a demand there is.
At Project Hope, the real constraint is the number of addiction counselors. Anyone who gets a prescription also has to check in monthly with a therapist. And for patients on Medicaid, those experts can be tough to find. Project Hope provides them, but has limited staff, so they can only help about 100 patients at any time. Peer advocate Danielle Orlando says that therapy has been essential. It helped her confront old traumas she tried to numb with drugs.
Just dealing with some of those demons that I've been trying to cover up for so long, it really helps. So the Suboxone is definitely not just a miracle drug that just fixes everything. You have to do, you know, your work. And that's what I did, and that's what I try to explain to people. You know, got to go back to move forward.
I'm Jessica McDonald, WHYY News.
Election year stories focus on the roster of candidates vying for office. A new effort sheds light on Pennsylvania public servants who've also worked in private energy and environment sectors. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has compiled an interactive online archive of nearly 40 high-level notables who've switched sides over the past decade. Marie, thanks for joining us again on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure.
I went to the site, and it opens with a nifty explainer video. For those who haven't seen it yet, explain.
Well, we built this site to showcase the movements of high-level state government officials between the public and private sector. So when you come to State Impact's website, you'll click on it and see a video explaining how to use it. Basically, down the left-hand side of the page, you have the years going back in time, about a decade, and then you see faces of all these, as I said, high-level people moving back and forth. The left side of the screen is the public sector. The right side is the private sector. And as you click through the years, there's almost like a square dance of faces going back and forth.
And the chronology is based year by year, starting, I believe, in 2007. That takes us back to the Rendell administration.
Correct. And State Impact Pennsylvania covers the energy boom around Marcellus shale drilling. So I thought that would be a good point in time to start. I kind of had to pick an arbitrary point in time because some of these people are older and have long resumes. Other people are younger and shorter resumes. But we decided to go back to 2007, which is roughly the beginning of the shale boom. And so far, we've had a Democrat Rendell, a Republican Tom Corbett, and now we have a Democratic administration again with Governor Tom Wolf. So there's been a lot of people cycling in and out.
Well, let's start with the former Governor Rendell. He has quite an extensive curriculum vitae.
He does. His assistant sent me a list of, I believe it was 38 different business ventures that he's involved with currently. I didn't list all of those on the site. I just picked a few. You know, he's a consultant to a number of companies, including a compressed natural gas vehicle company. He is a very vocal person in the media. He's an analyst for NBC and MSNBC. Yeah, he's been quite busy.
Is the intent of the site in part to raise questions about potential improprieties?
That wasn't my intent. My intent really was to show the movements. I'm not accusing anyone in here of any specific ethical violations, but I think the public deserves to have confidence that public officials are acting in the public interest and not helping themselves or their friends or their business associates. You know, a lot of the companies you find in here that are linked to high-level people have also gotten sizable state grants, for example.
What does the state ethics law say about what can and cannot be done after leaving government?
Well, if you're a public official, the state ethics law bars you from lobbying the government body you are affiliated with for 1 year. So that's kind of like a buffer to try to prevent the kind of revolving door thing you see. But when you talk to government reform groups and people who would like to see the law strengthened, there's a lot of loopholes around it. For example, Governor Corbett's his top energy executive, Patrick Henderson, immediately left the Corbett administration to become a lobbyist for the Marcellus Shale Commission, which is the state's largest gas industry trade group. Now, he is currently barred from lobbying the governor's office because he worked in the governor's office, but he can still lobby the legislature. Government reform groups would like to see that buffer year extended to 2 years. And they'd like to see your sphere of influence broadened because obviously somebody in the governor's office has a broad sphere of influence beyond just the governor's office.
The site is part of the focus on energy, environment, and Pennsylvania's blurred lines. Where else is this investigation going?
Well, we started here with just the visualization of what I see as a reporter. I would like to dig into some of those ties that I've seen. Like I mentioned, some of these companies have gotten sizable state grants, so I'd like to look into that further. But really, what I wanted to show people is you hear a lot about the revolving door, and as a reporter sitting in these public hearings and committee meetings in Harrisburg, you see it a lot. You know, a lot of the time, the people who are sitting up next to the secretary of the department, when the administration changes, now they're in the back of the room as a lobbyist. I just thought it would be good for the public to also be able to see this in a visual way.
Thanks, Marie.
You're very welcome.
State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick on WHYY. One of the architects of the Philadelphia Sound died yesterday. Guitarist T.J. Tyndall played on major funk and R&B records in the 1970s. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that he was as generous as he was clever.
T.J. Tyndall was part of the house band for Philadelphia International Records, heard on huge hits like Disco Inferno and The Sound of Philadelphia. David Ossikonen, the drummer for the band The Hooters, recently collaborated with Tyndall. He says Tyndall could figure out what was best for the song.
His choices weren't like, I'm going to play this because this is what people would think is cool. He would play what was right. Sometimes that's like being a subtle guitar part. You know, a lot of guitar players are looking for flash. He came up with the part that was like, whoa, you know, how'd you think of that?
Tyndall came up with this riff. Producers Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff used it as the basis of the Jackson 5 song Enjoy Yourself. Tyndall had basically retired from music until a few years ago when Ossikonen asked him to play for an ongoing cover song project. They were going to head back into the studio next week. Tyndall was 65 years old and had been suffering from a long illness. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. We're just 5 days out from the opening salvo of the 2016 presidential election, Monday's Iowa caucuses. Tomorrow evening, we'll get a close-up look at that unique process with David Redlosk of the Rutgers Eagleton poll. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.